calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The Iraq Study Group is out. Well, it came out last week, actually. And being sniped at from every possible direction, including the White House. Yaron Brook is with us. He's the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Ayn Rand, of course, wrote Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged and many other books. Came up with Objectivism, this very, very...
Hey there.
I don't want to use the word conservative, because I know, Yaron, you wouldn't use that word.
No, I wouldn't.
Are you close enough to the mic?
Very, you fill in the blank form of a worldview that puts economics first and foremost before, in my opinion, democracy. How would you say that?
Oh, no. Economics is a consequence. It puts reason and individual rights before everything else. Reason, individual rights,
awesome.
Indeed, before democracy.
Right.
Individual rights is what makes this country unique.
Yeah, exactly.
And you shouldn't be able to democratically vote away somebody's rights.
Right. For example, you shouldn't be able to democratically vote to force everybody to have Social Security.
You shouldn't be able to force me to pay for somebody else's Social Security or to force me not to.
In your mind.
That sort of
this is why I think that, you know, AYNRAND.org, the website, and it's why, you know, I like having you on, because you're just, you know, upfront and honest about this stuff. And whereas so many of these conservatives who have borrowed from Ayn Rand's thinking, particularly libertarians, you know, they kind of want to weasel around this stuff. And we often talk economics, and we will in the future. But today, I wanted to get you. You just wrote a piece about the Iraq Study Group that really pushed my buttons here, and you're suggesting that Iran and Syria are our enemies, and that we should be basically going after them, or alternatively, we should refuse to talk to them. I don't get it. You know, we talked to the Soviet Union for years and years and years. I mean, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, we installed a hotline between us and the Soviet Union. Henry Kissinger put this thing together. He said the greatest danger of war seems to me not to be in the deliberate actions of wicked men, but in the inability of harassed men to manage events that have run away from them. And thus we put in the hotline. Why don't you think that we should be talking with Iran and Syria?
Well, I don't think we need a hotline with Iran. Our existence is not at stake like it was in the Soviet Union. Mutual assured destruction is not yet. It will be one day if we leave the Iranians alone. Is not yet a possibility with either Iran or Syria. Both countries are enemies of the United States, declared enemies, explicit enemies of the U.S., particularly Iran, which I believe has been at war with the U.S. since 1979, is responsible for numerous terrorist attacks against the U.S., is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Americans throughout the decades, but particularly in Iraq. It ferments both the Sunni oppositions and the Shiites. They are responsible for much of what's going on there, and are building nuclear weapons with explicit purpose of eradicating our one ally in the Middle East, Israel, off the map.
You know, I find
and ultimately going after the U.S. They say so.
Yaron Brook, last week, George W. Bush said Iran's stated goal of building nuclear weapons. It was a lie. The actual fact of the matter is that Iran has stated over and over and over again that they have no intention of building nuclear weapons. There is no evidence that they've enriched uranium beyond 4%. You have to enrich to 96% to build a nuclear weapon, to 3.5% to power a nuclear power plant. Ahmadinejad has come out and said it would be a violation of the Quran, as have several of the mullahs, to create a weapon of mass destruction in the proportions of a nuclear weapon. And which is not to say that they're not lying. Again, I agree with Ronald Reagan, with trust but verify, but the fact of the matter is that the Iranians have also said that they are perfectly willing to have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association, come, you know, the weapons inspectors, the atomic weapons inspectors from the UN, come in and supervise every part of their nuclear program. They're totally up for that. Why is it that Bush is lying about this, and why is it that you're being so hysterical about it in the face of this?
Well, because they're lying. The fact is that they violated.
Well, then send in the inspectors.
Violated, you know very well that they have violated the treaties they've signed in the past, that indeed they won't.
What, you think Israel hasn't?
Let the inspectors in. The International Atomic Commission, it says they won't.
The United States has violated treaties. We violated 1441 when we invaded Iraq. There's not a country on earth that hasn't violated a treaty somewhere, somehow.
These, you know, the International Atomic Commission itself is saying that they have violated the agreements, that they're not letting inspectors go to sensitive sites, that they are enriching uranium. When they were offered deals by the Russians, where the Russians would enrich uranium and just give them the fuel, they rejected those offers. They have been stalling, and this is, and there's nothing new here. This is exactly the tactic.
That's
this
because
is exactly
they're, no,
the
no, hey, just a second, Yaron, rather than just shouting over each other, they are saying that if Bush stops his rhetoric against them, and if we will engage in conversation with them, they will open all this stuff up. What's wrong with that?
Well, why do they need us to stop our talking in order to allow...
Because we just invaded their neighbor, and we're talking about invading them.
What about their president stopped talking about, doing away with the state of Israel and destroying. What about them stopping on Fridays in the mosques declaring death to America, which is common practice since 1979 at every mosque in Iran? They declare death to America on the Friday prayers. What about them stopping that? Why is the burden on the
United
States?
I agree with you.
Let me just add one thing, Tom. This is exactly the same pattern that North Korea engaged in, exactly the same lies, exactly the same, oh, we're willing to have inspectors, don't worry about it, and of course, we all know that they have nuclear weapons.
And
today.
How much plutonium North Korea made during the presidency of Bill Clinton?
Oh, lots of it.
No, none.
Lots of it.
Zero.
That's not true.
Zip. Nada. None. True. They started
So it's Bush's fault in North Korea. Now, I'm not
it was. When Bush started, when he put them in with the Axis of Evil, that's when they took down the cameras and they kicked out the inspectors and they started enriching uranium.
North Korea enriched uranium during
let's get back to the Middle East here. Let's get back to the Middle East.
But there's a pattern.
Let me just bring up something here, Yaron. I agree with you. No, hang on just a second. I'm going to agree with you for a minute. Surprisingly. I agree with you that it's a terrible thing that any religion be promoting hatred and death. You know, yes, death to America, death to Israel. I just think it's a shame that that is happening in Iran to the extent that it's happening. The westernization of Iran, however, is startling and dramatic. I've talked with two people now in the last month who have come back from Iran, and they say, you know, hey, they're actually quite pro-American.
Yeah.
But setting the government, they're not speaking with the government, obviously, for the people. But the fact of the matter is that Saudi Arabia is actively and aggressively exporting Wahhabism. Wahhabism that teaches that Jews and that Americans should be put to death. Wahhabism that informed Osama bin Laden. Wahhabism that led to the 9/11 disasters. Saudi Arabia is the primary patron, not officially by the state, but through wealthy families. And really, as you know, it's impossible in these kingdoms to extricate wealthy families from the state. Saudi Arabia is primarily responsible for supporting the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, far and beyond any extent that Iran may be supporting the Shia insurgency in Iraq. They don't need to. The Shia are the majority in Iraq. Why is nobody talking about Saudi Arabia?
Well, as you know, I've been on your show dozens of times since September 11th on this issue, and I've always talked about Saudi Arabia. In my view, the two enemies of the United States in the Middle East are Saudi Arabia and Iran. One, the exporter and supporter of extremist radical Sunni Islam, and one of extremist radical Shiite Islam. Both are enemies. Both need to be dealt with if we're ever going to live in peace.
Isn't there
with the Middle
equation?
East?
Isn't there a simple equation here, though, Yaron Brook, who with AynRand.org, Ayn Rand, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, a simple equation, and that is if we were no longer exporting oil from that region. I mean, you know, the old joke, if Iraq's primary export was broccoli, we never would have invaded. If we were no longer buying oil from Iran and from Saudi Arabia, and we are buying it from both,
that
to a large extent the situation would resolve itself.
Well, it's true that if by some miracle oil stopped being a significant natural resource for the world.
Well, that
today,
miracle would be
whatever,
government spending.
Let me finish. Whatever the world is, whether it's the United States, Europe, or Asia, if it somehow stopped being a significant natural resource, the countries would be bankrupt. They'd be back to their nomadic states, and they would not pose a threat to us. The threat comes
right. So
from
why
the
don't we tax ourselves to pay for alternative for the development of alternative energy in a Manhattan Project type way?
Because the way you create
you want to wait for the free market to do it.
For two reasons. One is the way you create alternative energy is not through government funding.
That's how
that
we built the bomb.
That is the way to destroy. It's true.
It's how we built nuclear power.
Government is very good at creating weapons.
It's how we built nuclear power.
Of value for human productivity. And the second is that I don't think Iran owns its oil, and I don't think Saudi Arabia owns its oil, just any more than I own the oil in Texas. That is, I don't think it's theirs to use to back my house.
You don't think that people should own the natural resources?
I think corporations and individuals should own natural
not
resources,
the state.
Not
so
the
you
state.
Think what Alaska is doing is wrong?
Absolutely.
Interesting. Ayn Rand, Institute, AYNRAND.org. G. Yarnbrook, the President and Executive Director. Yarn, always interesting talking with you. I appreciate you coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
When this war is over, it will be better day.
Indeed it will. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. You're in the real free speech zone. Some interesting questions here. First of all, with regard to the Iraq Study Group, why is it that it's, the average age is, what, 71 on this thing? Only one of these guys actually went outside the green zone. Only five of them even went to Baghdad. And you've got Baker and Eagleburger. Eagleburger used to be on the board of directors of Halliburton. Baker is representing the government of Saudi Arabia against the 9/11 families in their lawsuit. And one of the main recommendations of the Iraq Study Group, let's privatize the oil. Let's let the big American oil companies come in. What's wrong with this picture? So there's that. There's that. And Bush is still saying, no, I'm going to refuse to talk to these people. I'm not going to talk to them. Nope, I'm not going to talk to them. No siree, Bob. Ain't going to happen. And I just, you really have to, at a certain level, wonder what's the deal with this? This is tragic. There was a time. There was a very different time in America.
To those people in the huts and villages of half the globe struggling to break the bonds of mass misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves. For whatever period is required, not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich.
This is John Kennedy from his inaugural. I mean, just pretty straightforward stuff, really, when you think about it, It's
to that World Assembly of Sovereign States, the United Nations, our last best hope, in an age where the instruments of war have far outpaced the instruments of peace, we renew our pledge of support to prevent it from becoming merely a forum for invective, to strengthen its shield of the new and the weak, and to enlarge the area in which its writ may run.
And then Kennedy kind of nailed it down with this one.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
And now we have a guy running the presidency in the White House who is both fearful and unwilling to negotiate. Okay, point number one. Number two, here, an interesting question over at the blueoregon.blog. This kind of a local story, but it's not a local story. It's a San Francisco man, James Kim, who died in the forest on the mountain, on the mountainside, here in Oregon. And he was with his wife and two kids in the car for about a week, and finally he left the car and died about a mile short, ironically or sadly, tragically, of a lodge that was, you know, open and full of food and things. And the question that was asked, and I ask you this, this is an interesting one. Did James Kim die because of the war? Because traditionally, we would have sent out the National Guard. But in Oregon, most of our National Guard is in Iraq. And an awful lot of their equipment is in Iraq. Now, there's also the problem of the possibility that some hunters or some vandals cut the gate. This is Governor Ted Kulongoski, the governor of Oregon.
The map clearly says that this road is closed in the wintertime. He went on that road, the Bear Creek Road, and what happened quite a ways up there, there was a logging road off to the right, a fork. It is on BLM land. There's traditionally a gate there. My understanding is that some vandals had broken the lock and had sprung the gate open, and then because of the weather and the time of day and everything, he went down that road.
Now, this is a conversation I had with the governor on Friday of last week, and he said, you know, some vandals popped open the lock. So this, you know, let's not blame this on James Kim. Somebody else, one of the people in this blog says, let's don't forget to blame the online mapping service that apparently led them astray. Is that possible? Another is that James Kim's father had to hire private helicopters to search for his son. But the helicopter that found him was not actually one of those. It was by a fellow by the name of John Ranchor, a rancher and owner of several Burger Kings, who used his own helicopter to look at the area. He found the car. He radioed it to the hired helicopters. Again, where's the National Guard? And then who is it who popped open the gate? Well, it was elk season, or specifically elk season in the Southern Oregon Coastal Range, November 10th through the 14th, 17th through the 25th. 95 tags were issued. Maybe we should be tracking down elk hunters. I mean, you know, it's a lot of tragedy to go around here. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin. And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Republicans are starting to, what is it, roll over, flip, turn. The worm is turning. Change, tap dance, pick your lousy cliche or metaphor. Senator Gordon Smith leading the pack. Gordon Smith, of course, the guy, again, it's... You know, here I am with a couple of Oregon stories. This is really rare. I talk about Oregon probably fewer than once every 3 months on this program, and yet he's all over the press this weekend. George Stephanopoulos, the whole thing, and a prominent right wing Republican. This is a guy who has voted with George W. Bush more than 90% of the time. The corporate-owned, the Oregonian, the newspaper in this state, it's owned by Newhouse out of New York, always puts the word moderate before his name. But the fact of the matter is, Gordon Smith is no moderate. He's a right-wing crank. And he has voted for the war. He has voted for keeping the war going. I mean, at every level and in every way, Gordon Smith has been voting for the war. For example, on 9/28/06, on vote number 259, Senate Bill 3930, as amended the Military Commissions Act, he voted yes on that. Yes, let's do away with habeas corpus. Let's do away with posse comitatus. On 6/22/06, the Levin Amendment to state the sense of Congress on United States policy in Iraq. In other words, Congress saying, this is not binding. This is just Congress saying, you know, we probably shouldn't be in Iraq. He voted no. This was just a few months ago. Also just a few months ago in June. On the Kerry Amendment, number 4442, to require the redeployment of U.S. armed forces in Iraq in order to further a political solution in Iraq, encourage the people of Iraq to provide for their own security, and achieve victory of the war on terror, he voted no. And on Senate Bill 2766, an amendment called on the president to withdraw troops from Iraq, but with no timeline, he voted no. So this is a guy who as recently as a few months ago is gung-ho for the war, and now all of a sudden he's saying something different.
And I, for one, am at the end of my rope when it comes to supporting a policy that has our soldiers patrolling the same streets in the same way, being blown up by the same bombs day after day. That is absurd. It may even be criminal.
Whoa.
I cannot support that anymore. And I believe we need to figure out not just how to leave Iraq, but how to fight the war on terror and to do it right.
Now, it's interesting you watch this clip on C-SPAN, and he's looking, you know, he's waving and gesturing like he's giving a giant speech, but the Senate was empty when he gave this speech. The only person watching this speech was the cameraman, first of all. So this is entirely for consumption at home, although it turned into a national story. And then he goes on this week with George Stephanopoulos. And, hey, wait a minute. You said that what the president is doing is criminal?
And Senator Smith, let me begin with you. That was clearly a deeply personal speech, and it showed a dramatic change of heart. What triggered it?
Waking up the other morning and turning on the news.
And discovering that the Democrats had won the Congress.
Hearing that yet another 10 of our soldiers died the same way several thousand
Wednesday.
Now, this is the guy who was gung-ho for all the other soldiers dying. All of a sudden, these last 10, no, he's not. This is not just a passive supporter of the war. This is not just somebody who stood on the sidelines. This is somebody who is actively voting not to bring the troops home as recently as June. What is that, 5 months ago? This is year after year after year. He supported the president on this, and now all of a sudden he's backpedaling. How many more Republicans are coming down the road on this? Here's Gordon Smith.
I bombs, and I went from steam to boiled.
Yeah, right.
And I felt I had to speak out because...
Because your political fate was, future was in trouble.
If we're going to be there, let's win. If we're not, let's at least fight the war on terror in a way.
Let's win. This is why John McCain's calling for 20,000 additional troops, because he knows that it won't happen. Nobody's going to be that stupid. It's like the Christmas bombing of Hanoi. Let's put 450,000 troops in like we did in Vietnam. I mean, the population of Iraq isn't all that different from the population of Vietnam. Well, how about 500,000 troops? Maybe that'll work. No, I'm sorry, it won't. People, if Canada and Mexico invaded the United States, I would be out there with a gun protecting my country, and odds are you would be too. You can't defeat an insurgency. You can't defeat people who believe that they are defending their homeland, particularly when you've killed 600,000 of them, and everybody has a brother, cousin, uncle, father, niece, nephew, sister, mother who has been killed by your actions. It doesn't happen. It never has. The French fought the Indochina War, the Vietnamese for 47 years, and finally gave up and left. I mean, it's just, you know, the ongoing history of this. The French left Lebanon in what, 1918, 1921, I forget the year, but it was early, right around that time, after a half a century of trying to subdue it. It just doesn't work.
You said in that speech the current policy may be criminal.
I said it. You can use any adjective you want, George.
Oh, really? We can use any adjective. How about criminal? How about, are you calling for George W. Bush to go to jail or Don Rumsfeld? No. He's a good Republican. He's not going to say that.
But I have long believed, in a military context, when you do the same thing over and over again, without a clear strategy for victory, at the expense of your young people in arms, that is dereliction. That is deeply immoral.
Dereliction of duty. Now, here's the problem. Rumsfeld is a civilian. Bush is a civilian. I'm not sure that they can be convicted of dereliction. Dereliction of duty is something that you're guilty of under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Perhaps somebody who's a JAG officer will call and correct me on this, but I find it interesting. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. And, of course, you can drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. Our telephone number, Joe in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program. Oh, hang on just a second, Joe. Let me just put you on. Okay. All righty. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, Joe. Hey, Tom. I just want to make the point that I don't think, if you look historically, that you can actually ever trust anything that neither Democrat nor Republican says publicly in big stump speeches, like you're talking about Bush not wanting to talk to Iran or Syria. And it seems that they'll say whatever they need to say politically at the time that they're saying it. But behind closed doors, they do the opposite. If you look at Carter, for example, talked about peace in the Middle East and talking about negotiating and diplomacy, while Brzezinski, his Secretary of State, I believe, was the guy who came up with the plan of funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to lure in the Soviets. Then you have Reagan and Bush, his CIA director, coming up with plans to fund both Iran and Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. There's evidence that they had a secret deal with the Islamic radicals during the 79 hostage crisis. There were some memos and evidence that was leaked that they had a deal before the election for them not to release the hostages until after the election, so Carter would look bad.
Oh, sure. This is the October surprise. But you're not talking about the George W. Bush administration. I believe when he says, I'm not going to talk to somebody, he's not going to talk to them.
I think he might talk to them, but there are going to be secret deals, maybe through back channels, Pakistan, Israel.
No, he's going to try and get somebody else to do it, the same way he got bailed out of Hark and Oil with Solomon Bin Laden's money, the same way he got into and out of the Texas Rangers. I mean, it's always, let somebody else take care of it. I'm George W. Bush. I'm entitled.
I hear that. Beyond Bush, Cheney, whoever's doing the real force and foreign policy planning, I think are going to have their operatives, whether it be the CIA, other secret back channel, back door meetings going on. I don't know why, there's always people going over for meetings with world leaders. Cheney went over to Saudi Arabia recently. I don't know what they were talking about, but.
I think it was the Saudis calling him in. This is a proxy war. What's going on in Iraq right now, it didn't start out that way. What it has become is a proxy war between Iraq, being the Sunnis in Iraq being funded and supported by the Saudis, and the Shia in Iraq being funded and supported by the Iranians to some extent. And obviously there's strong factions on both sides within the country. But ultimately, this could become a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
I see. That's interesting. I also think that you make an interesting point about Bush wanting to put another strong man in there.
He would absolutely love to have, I mean, he needs to have another Saddam Hussein.
Right.
Pull that guy out of jail and put him in power. So, obviously, it's not going to be that, but some equivalent of that.
Right. And that's
why they're setting up, by the way. That's why they're setting up Maliki to be the fall guy.
No,
he's
going to
be
right
out of office in 3 months.
I think you're right on with that. I think that was a good point you were making the other day. I was listening.
Yeah.
So, I think there's just a long history, with Iran and Iraq. They just fund both sides. They'll pick a side publicly.
Yeah, and the bottom line is, if we had listened to Jimmy Carter back in 1979 when he said, we will never again import more oil into this country than we did in 1974, and by the year 2000 we will have a solar bank that will produce 20% of our electricity needs, and he had the means to do it and a plan, and Reagan shut that down. If we had listened to him, we would not be in this mess right now. 45 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, the listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen carefully for the sponsors on your local program. Let them know that you're listening and patronize their products. And also our national sponsors, such as Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, all organic, all fair trade. 1-800-425-2532, Sacred Grounds smalldogcoffee.com on the web. And Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now. 1-800-511-MAX. Smalldog.com is their website. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And David in Arlington, Washington. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. You got a great show. I'm glad you're on.
Thank you.
I think as far as the Iraqi war goes, it's the occupation. Excuse me. It's going to continue. This is exactly how President Bush and his cronies wanted it. They wanted chaos over there, and that's what they've got. He doesn't give a hoot about the soldiers. Chaos is what they wanted.
I'm sorry, David, but I can't believe that Bush wanted 3,000 dead soldiers. I mean, this is political suicide for him. I really think that he, in his deluded way, and Rumsfeld as well, thought that they could. I mean, they really believe their right wing spin. They look back. The Republicans have been doing this since the 1940s. They look back at what Harry Truman did with the Marshall Plan. Harry Truman and George Marshall with the Marshall Plan in Europe and the help that we provided rebuilding Japan, where we encouraged those countries to have strong national health care programs, strong protections for unions, well-regulated economies rather than laissez-faire economics, progressive income taxation, just basic structural stuff like Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman in some cases got into place and in other cases tried to and were unsuccessful. And it produced two very powerful economies. And the conservatives ever since then have been saying, oh, that was all just an anomaly. That was just the Japanese and Germans are industrious. We need a country where we can go in and change the Constitution. And that's what they did in Iraq. They eliminated the progressive tax and replaced it with a 15% flat tax. They banned unions. They said that any corporation can do anything they want in the country and they can employ people from outside the country. They can bring in all the foreign labor they want. Forget about immigration rules. And so Iraq now has a 50-60% unemployment rate. They thought they were creating a conservative paradise. They really and truly believed their own PR, and it didn't work.
Meantime, they've bankrupted our country, and none of our social programs will ever be enacted for at least another generation because we're in the hole.
Yeah, that's been part of their plan ever since Reagan. I mean, you know, David Stockman talked about that, the whole Star of the Beast strategy that Reagan came up with, which is, you know, run the country so far into debt that we're going to have to do away with Medicare, where there's no possibility of a national health insurance program. We have to do away with any kind of social safety net. And simply privatize everything, but I don't believe that in Iraq they went in wanting to have 5 years of conflict. I think they really thought that their ideology was right. It has never been successful anywhere in the world in the past, but that doesn't keep true believers from believing. And I think that that's where they were at. David, thanks for the call. Lois in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lois.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that libertarian gentleman from the Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of libertarians personally, and they like to talk about the free market. They practically worship it.
Mm-hmm.
But how come they never protest against corporations? Like when during the beginning of this war, when Bush was giving all these no-bid contracts to corporations, that's not free market, no-bid contracts.
Well, actually, the Ayn Rand folks, to give them their due, as much as you know, we like to beat up on each other, I think that they would be opposed to that as well. They're opposed to any transfer of tax dollars to anybody, including corporations.
I've never heard of a libertarian protesting a corporation.
Well, the Ayn Rand folks have on this program, Yaron Brook on this program, has talked about how he doesn't think that corporations should be recipients, anybody should be recipient of government programs. He just doesn't think that there should be government programs, period.
But he doesn't consider the military a government program?
Well, that's the exception. And well, actually, you know, that's a good topic. Lois, the next time we get him on, I'll ask him about the privatization of military functions, because it's a good point. Thank you very much. Mark in Florence, Oregon. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Morning to you, Tom.
Hey.
Tom, there's an article on BBC Online within the last month or so. It was reported on Mr. Cedar's show about how they don't have any metering devices. The devices are turned off or they're just not present on the offloading of oil out of Iraq.
Yeah, the extent to which it is meters, it's metered by the tanker. You know, how many tankers have you gotten out of here? Which is actually not all that imperfect a way of measuring it.
Oh, I didn't know that. Tom, the other thing I was wondering, if maybe in the great thought mill of your mind, I just wanted to enter this in there, is there some way, if not presently on a legal basis, that the states could legislate themselves or either through sympathy in the U.S. Congress could have legislated a means to keep more of our federal income tax dollars back into the states without having them turn into federal income tax dollars, but rather remain state revenue to provide the goods and services which really get ripped off from the American people by the king in Washington, D.C. at this point.
Well, you know, that was the philosophy behind Medicaid. You know,
yes.
let the states administer it. It was the philosophy behind probably 50%. I'm not an authority on welfare programs, but behind about half of the welfare programs was that they were administered by the states and the states used them. And to some extent, there were block grants coming back. But by and large, it was, you know, state money. The problem that you get into is when the federal government mandates that states do things and doesn't fund it, you get a lot of blowback from the states, and justifiably so. And to some extent, some folks would say that that's even a violation of the Ninth Amendment of the Constitution.
So, okay, well, thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. 56 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with Stephanie Mensimer blocking the courthouse door, how the Republican Party and its corporate allies are taking away your right to sue. And you won't believe what the FBI is doing with your cell phones. That and more after the news at the top of the hour right here on the Tom Hartland radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So here's how the story goes. The American people are greedy SOBs. They're all out there to get whatever they can, and the greediest among them are the trial lawyers. Oh, man, they are terrible. These awful trial lawyers. People go to McDonald's just to spill coffee on their laps. People go to the doctor just hoping that the doctor will screw up some way. People buy swimming pools just hoping that they can get sucked into a drain someplace so that they can sue, so that they can get rich. It's the new lottery in America. Anybody who's ever smoked a cigarette wants to sue a tobacco company. We're all out to get rich. It's the new lottery system in America. That, at least, is the right-wing story. That's the right-wing spin. That's the spin that the big multinational corporations have been putting on this thing for the better part of 30 years, from subtle little things on Paul Harvey to great big news stories to news releases on an unrelenting basis. And Stephanie Mensimer says no. Ain't the case. She's the author of a new book, Blocking the Courthouse Door, How the Republican Party and its corporate allies are taking away your right to sue. Her website, thetortellini.com. You'll find links to her website over at tomhartman.com, over on our message board and our blog. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. Okay. I think everybody in America knows, even though they don't know that it's wrong, they know that there was this lady who spilled some McDonald's coffee in her lap and as a result walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars, and how terrible that is.
Well, she didn't walk away with hundreds of millions of dollars. I think no one knows exactly how much she got, but it was in the not millions of dollars. The verdict was overturned, and I actually think that lady, if that had been your grandmother, you'd probably think she deserved a lot more.
Why?
The coffee that spilled on her, it caused third-degree burns on her inner thighs and her private parts, required extensive skin grafts. She spent, I think, over a week in the hospital, was disabled, was unable to walk for a while. Her daughter had to almost quit her job to take care of the woman because she didn't have enough health insurance to cover the cost. And she initially asked McDonald's just to pay for her hospital bill, and they said, no, we'll give you $600 and some coupons or something. And she was left with so much to pay for her medical bills that she ended up having to sue. And it turned out that McDonald's coffee had been spilling on people and burning them for a long time. And McDonald's knew it was too hot, but they didn't do anything about it until after the verdict in that case. It was in New Mexico, when they finally lowered the temperature of the coffee so that it wouldn't, I guess they actually knew that the temperature of their coffee was so high it could peel your skin off the bone. It was
Why would
that
you
bad.
Do that?
Sorry?
Why would any company sell a product that they know is that destructive?
That is a good question. I think the problem was that the coffee didn't taste very good when it was at a lower temperature, so they were going to have to buy a more, you know, sophisticated brand. I'm not really sure what the rationale was.
Interesting. So in your book, Blocking the Courthouse Door, How the Republican Party and Its Corporate Allies Are Taking Away Your Right to Sue, Stephanie Mensimer, you talk about this broad strategy that was hatched by inside the Republican Party to defund the Democratic Party. There have been two traditional major funders of the Democratic Party, and they've both been the folks who stand up for the little guy, the unions. And Ronald Reagan declared war on the unions in 1980, and we've gone from 25% of the American workforce being unionized to now it's about 7% of the private workforce. And the trial lawyers who essentially defend the little guy as well. And you suggest in your book that there is a concerted effort in the name of what they call tort reform to eliminate the ability of you and me to protect ourselves against predatory corporations.
Yes.
Okay. Give me some examples.
Well, let's see. I can tell you what's happened already. Texas is the classic case where they're, well, in the political side, if it weren't for trial lawyers, there would be no Democratic Party in Texas. They're the only source of funding for progressive political candidates there. And so Texas has had some huge tort reform that's limited people's ability to sue.
Haven't they defined, like, the value of a life at $250,000, period, end of discussion?
Yes. And what's happened since they did that in 2003 is it's become almost impossible to sue nursing homes over negligent care because older people don't have lost wages and they don't have jobs, so they can't claim that they've lost income. So they only have non-economic damages to sue for. And now that that's capped at $250,000, it can cost up to $150,000 just to bring one of these cases to trial. So it's not economically viable anymore to sue a nursing home. Several of the law firms that specialize in suing nursing homes just closed up shop after that bill passed. So now, if your grandmother has been killed by negligent care in a nursing home in Texas, you have no recourse. The company can just get away with it. Yeah.
Tough luck. I'll tell you a personal story, and you can tell me if this is anomalous or characteristic. In 1950, my father came back from World War II, and as a young man, wanted to go to college, actually went to college on the GI Bill. He was going to college, wanted to be a history professor, in fact. He married my mother, and he had the GI Bill, and he was working part-time in a camera shop. She became pregnant, and as a result of that, he had to drop out of college. It was unexpected, and went to work in a steel and aluminum mill in Grand Rapids, Michigan, surrounded by a cloud of asbestos. I mean, the hot steel or whatever the metal was, they did aluminum there as well, came out of the thing off on these asbestos rollers, and he would come home covered with asbestos. And he did that for a couple of years, year and a half or so, until he was able to get a better job. And as a consequence of that, about 6 years ago, he went into the hospital for something unrelated, and they discovered that he had mesothelioma, which is a very, very deadly, very rapidly acting form of lung cancer. They gave him a few months to live and sewed him up and sent him home. I started poking around on the Internet. I found that in 1950, when my mother got pregnant with me, and you know, I was the cause of all this in a way. So I have a personal, I have some personal feelings around it. In any case, I discovered that the asbestos companies knew full well that their product caused mesothelioma, but they were using the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment to not tell anybody about it. You know, the right to privacy and the right not to incriminate themselves. That the steel company knew about it at the time. That over the years, my dad then went to work in a tool and die shop in Lansing for the next 40 years, and I remember sitting, walking home from school and sitting there playing with the rolls of asbestos, corrugated asbestos that the steel would come in, and just breaking it up and being marveling at the fibers, you know. And when he was diagnosed with this, we started calling some of the guys that he worked with. It was a 13-man tool and die shop. Four of them had died of mesothelioma.
Wow.
And so searching around the internet, I found a lawyer down in Texas and said, you know, I'd like you to sue on behalf of my dad because, you know, he's going to die and he's not a rich guy. He's got, you know, and my mom's going to need some long-term care. She, you know, it's, you know, here it is. And he did, and he took the case, but it was on a contingency basis. You know, he no fee up front.
Right.
He took a percentage. I think it was about half or maybe a third of whatever dad got. But he spent an awful lot of time and money on it. And my parents' house in Lansing, Michigan, this little three-bedroom house in which they raised four boys, you know, just a basic little middle-class house, 27 lawyers flew in from companies all over the United States.
Wow.
To stand in my dad's living room when they were doing the video deposition to harass him and throw insulting questions at him. And one lawyer representing him was there. It was the most god-awful, horrifying, sickening, want to puke. If I had a gun, it would have been a dangerous day, a kind of situation. Is that a common experience?
I think it is, especially you hear those stories of the people who sued tobacco companies. They really got put through the ringer. You know, people who were dying of lung cancer and then were grilled on their deathbed about whether they had
well,
ever...
Well, this is it. They were grilling him on his deathbed.
Yeah, and they want to know if you ever cheated on your husband, if you ever...
Oh, asking
you know,
him all kinds
meat.
Of absurd questions.
Yeah, and, you know, did you have mental health problems? Have you ever been exposed to various other things that might have caused this cancer? They want to know, you know, if stress might have caused your problem, and... The tobacco companies are famously ruthless for that, which is part of the reason that they were so successful in sending off all the lawsuits over the years from smokers, because they just ground down the plaintiffs, and you know people didn't want to get involved in that kind of thing if they were going to be subjected
to that
kind of...
And this is happening in the asbestos area, too, and now you've got all these Republicans wanting to make it impossible to sue on that. So right across the board, we have to wrap this up in just a few seconds, right across the board, increasingly, we're all losing our ability to hold corporations accountable. That's the bottom line.
That is the bottom line, yes.
It's a grim story. Stephanie Mensimer, her book, Blocking the Courthouse Door, How the Republican Party and its Corporate Allies Are Taking Away Your Right to Sue, and they're doing it, oddly enough, in the name of fairness, aren't they? It's absurd. The Tortellini.com, her website, you'll find links to it over at TomHartmann.com. Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And for writing a great book. Good on you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
Better than I knew myself, so I'm gonna let her do all the talking.
Ooh-hoo.
Ooh-hoo. I came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree.
Ooh-hoo.
I felt a little fear upon my back. I said, don't look back, just keep on walking.
Ooh-hoo.
And welcome back to the pillow. I'll help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Oh, man. The main story, I mean, this is, you know, screaming headline on all the tabloids. U.S. bugged Diana's phone on night of death crash. Well, that's the one everybody's talking about. What they're not talking about is the FBI listening in on your phone. No, I'm not talking about the criminal and illegal felony that the Bush repeated thousands, tens of thousands of felonies that the Bush administration committed in the so-called terrorist surveillance program in violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the FISA Act, by listening in on Americans' phone calls, or the sneak and peek provisions in the Patriot Act, or the wiretap provisions in the Patriot Act. Now, this goes beyond that. This from ABC News. I'll just read this straight up. Vic Walter and Chris Chickelman, ABC News, cell phone users, beware. The FBI can listen into everything you say, even when your cell phone is turned off. A recent court ruling in a case against the Genovese crime family revealed that the FBI has the ability from a remote location to activate a cell phone and turn its microphone into a listening device that transmits to an FBI listening post, a method known as a roving bug. Experts say the only way to defeat it is to remove the cell phone battery. David, pull the battery out of my cell phone there. This is nuts. The FBI can access cell phones and modify them remotely without ever having to physically handle them, says James Atkinson, a counterintelligence security expert, to ABC News. Any recently manufactured cell phone, he said, has a built-in tracking device which can allow eavesdroppers to pinpoint someone's location to within just a few feet, he added. According to a recent court ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Lewis Kaplan, quote, the device functioned whether the phone was powered on or off, intercepting conversations within its range wherever it happened to be. I can just see it now. You're going to start seeing it. You know, right now you see people walking down the street talking on their cell phone, and they got the little flip phone or the Razor phone or whatever. They're going to go back to those bricks. Remember the bricks? I had one of those things. When they first came out, it was, you know, the toy to have if you're in business. You know, or the old Motorola flip. I remember Motorola's first flip phone, you know, the size of like the size of two packs of cigarettes. But the bricks, yeah. I'll bet they can't do it with that. The court ruling denied motions by 10 defendants to suppress the conversations obtained by roving bugs. Richard Reebok, the attorney for the defendant, says the courts have given law enforcement a blank check for surveillance. Judge Kaplan disagreed. He says it simply dispenses with the need for repeated installations and surreptitious entry into buildings. Yeah, we don't have to break into your house to put a bug in anymore. All we have to do is know that you have a cell phone in your pocket. We can hear everything you say. Reebok disagrees. He says, Big Brother is upon us. 1984 happened a long time ago, referring to George Orwell's novel. The FBI maintains the message used in its surveillance and its investigation of the Genovese family are within the law, and goes on to say, they don't discuss sensitive surveillance techniques. Other than to emphasize that any electronic surveillance is done pursuant to a court order and ongoing judicial scrutiny. Well, at least the FBI is doing that. You know, the NSA under George W. Bush is not doing that. They're spying on Democrats. Yes, that's the assumption I'm operating under, and frankly, I think every Democratic member of Congress should be operating under. They're spying on Democrats with nothing against the law. A law that defies a law that provides 2 years in jail for every violation. George W. Bush has violated it thousands of times. What, is he going to spend 10,000 years in jail? I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. Time now for our China alert of the day. Over the past 5 years, I love this song. I bought this song in Beijing, the CD. It's actually from an opera. Anyhow, over the past 5 years, the size of China's economy has nearly doubled, writes Andrew Bateson in today's Wall Street Journal, with annual output surpassing $2 trillion. It's now the world's most populous nation, fourth largest economy, third largest exporter. But the growing size and sophistication of its domestic economy, now here's where it gets scary. Yeah, I'll just boil this down for you. Here's the bottom line. China used to have to buy all this stuff from us. Now they're selling everything from us, and they're selling things inside their country. So even though they're sitting on $1 trillion U.S. dollars, they don't much care. They don't much care. And a whole bunch of currencies now are starting to back away from the dollar. Could this be the beginning of a disaster for the dollar? Could it be the beginning? Could this be the thing that, you know, China, one of their military guys said, yeah, the United States, yeah, we could throw 100 nuclear missiles into 100 American cities. And nobody ever said anything about that. Somehow the media just kind of forgot that the communist China had threatened us like that. Well, I'll give you a little more about this after the break, and then we'll take your calls. 27 minutes past the hour. Here's how it works. Welcome back, by the way, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Here's how it works. Starting with Ronald Reagan. And that, you know, it's called the Reagan Revolution. There's a reason for that. It was a rollback of roughly 200 years of American history. of an American understanding of how the world worked and the purpose of government, and the idea that, you know, we're all in this together. I mean, there's these two fundamental notions. One is we're all in this together. That was the idea that liberals like George Washington had. George Washington, who said, "I hope I shall ever see America at the forefront of liberality," who proudly referred to himself as a liberal. As opposed to conservatives like Alexander Hamilton, who thought, "Oh, no, no, you just let business do everything. There should be no government involvement in anything." And the middle ground that we reached through most of American history, although we've had these waves, we've gone back and forth, there have been periods of time when the United States was primarily dominated by corporations and interests of the very, very wealthy, and periods of time when the United States has primarily been dominated by populists and people who believed in the interests of the people. From 1776 until roughly 1830, the United States was dominated by and large, by populists, by people who believed in the will of the people. From 1830 to the Civil War, it was corporations, and that led to a series of major depressions and recessions that led directly to the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln, the Republican Party, was created in Jackson, Michigan, and from 1856, I think it was June. And Abraham Lincoln was their first major candidate, the first presidential candidate. And it was a party of reform at the time, a populist party. And the people ran the country, basically, from then until the 1880s, when the Republicans took back over again, Ulysses S. Grant and whatnot, and sold out to the railroads and became the party of the railroad barons. Yeah, I know there was Grover Cleveland, and there was a Democrat in there, but basically it was the Republicans. Set aside Republican and Democrat, actually, because those labels are almost not useful in this context. From the 1880s, the Republicans the corporations rose up and took over until 1901. And then Teddy Roosevelt came along, a Republican. And he said, "We're going to break up these big corporations. We're going to bust this stuff up, the Trust Buster." And from 1901 until 1921, we had the people in charge again. And then in 1921, the corporations took charge again, and we had another era of the robber barons. And you'll recall that prior to the 1880s, there were no huge fortunes made in the United States. You can't name somebody from before 1870 who was a multi-zillionaire, a multi-billionaire in today's money. Because the rules of the game of business were set up that it just didn't happen. They were set up to build a middle class. Even John Hancock, the wealthiest of the founders, he didn't leave any dynasty. He was what in today's money would be upper middle class. His net worth, various estimates, but more or less in today's dollars, given how low the value of land was back then, probably about $700,000 his net worth. The richest of all the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence. Jefferson and Washington died in bankruptcy. So then came the 1880s, and we shifted to corporate rule, and the corporations took over. And then Teddy Roosevelt started busting them up, and so from 1900 to 1901, there were no more robber barons during that period of time. I mean, there were the established ones from the previous generation, the Rockefellers and the DuPonts and the Morgans and whatnot, Jay Gould, Samuel Huntington, the railroad barons. And then from 1921 until 1933, you had a new generation of the wealth. The Bushes, the Prescotts, the Kennedys rose up. And, of course, the old wealth was there. And then the Republican Great Depression put an end to that, and we went into a populist era again. And from 1933 until 1980, the golden age of the American middle class, as we came out of the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt put into place these rules that would create a middle class. And Reagan started deconstructing them. And so from 1980 to today, these last 26 years have been the era of the corporations and the robber barons again. In the 1970s, the average CEO in America made about 300 times what the average worker does. Now it's thousands of times, and in many cases over 10,000 times as much as the, if you're just looking at the Fortune 500 companies, it's more than 10,000 times as much as the average employee. In the 1950s, it was 30 to 300 times at the most. In most of the northern European countries, for that matter, even today, 30, 40, 50 times. So we're seeing the selling off of America. Now, how did they accomplish this? Well, first of all, Reagan started destroying labor, busting up PATCO, you know, this overt war on labor. And with the 1986 amnesty of illegal immigrants into the United States, he said, okay, you know, amnesty. And thus the labor pool in America began to increase. Well, when your labor pool increases, what happens to the cost of labor? It decreases. The history of progressivism in the United States, the progressive history of the United States has been the history of limiting access of labor to the workforce to drive up the cost of labor. Thus the 50-hour week, thus the 40-hour week, thus the child labor laws, thus the right to strike. So Reagan and Greenspan said, no, we're going to bust up the unions. When Reagan came into power, 25% of America's workforce was unionized. Now it's down to about 7%. And the other thing was, let's do away with this tariff system that built the United States. Now, back in 1787, the year the Constitution was written, there was an American businessman by the name of Tench Coxe. Tench Coxe had been an opponent of the revolution in the first place, thought it'd be bad for business, as were most of the people who were in business, and certainly all of the very, very wealthy. They all left. Most of them went to Canada or to England during or immediately after the Revolutionary War. And what we were left with, by and large, was a large middle class and a small upper middle class that was made up mostly of the founders and the framers. Although, actually, a lot of the people at the Constitutional Convention were just farmers. I don't mean big estate owners. I'm talking about, you know, New England farmers. And what they had put into place, what Tench Coxe put into place was, he said, we have to protect industry in the United States. We had to protect business in the United States. So if it costs a dollar, if there's a dollar's worth of labor at a pair of shoes made in the United States, if you're going to make that pair of shoes in China or in Mexico or in Italy or someplace else, and you can make it for a lot less labor, say you can make it for 20 cents in China, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. But we're going to charge you 80 cents when you import it. It's called an import tariff. And at Tench Coxe's urging, he was the first lobbyist, Congress passed a law. It was actually wasn't called Congress at the time. This was before Congress. This was before the Constitution was ratified. This was when we were operating under the Articles of Confederation. But a law was passed with one of these big, long, you know, 30-word names. A law to protect the business within the United States, domestic, protect for the common good, and blah, blah, blah. I don't remember the name of it. I don't have it in front of me. That put into place this tariff system. Something that every other country had. There's a whole chapter about this in my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, that has all these details. And that tariff system not only built the largest industrial powerhouse in the world that the history of the world had ever seen, but tariffs provided 100% of the revenue for the federal government, the paycheck of every president, every senator, every member of Congress, the Supreme Court, everybody. It provided all of it right up until the Civil War. It provided two-thirds of it. Revenue from tariffs provided two-thirds of the American government's income from the Civil War to World War I, and a third of it from World War I to World War II. This was a big deal, and it was still a significant amount of money in 1980 when Reagan came into office. And Reagan came in, and his vice president, George Herbert Walker Bush, who was really running the show most of those years, he said, you know, we don't want this. We want a new world order. We want the corporations to run things. So let's have fast-track authority. Let's let the government negotiate these deals where countries can get around the tariffs. Let's give most favored nation status to countries like China. And let's let our corporations deal with them. And then Bill Clinton came along and said, yeah, let's kick out the doors altogether. Let's sign NAFTA and GATT and create the World Trade Organization. And the result? Right now, the sound recording industries in the United States, 97% of them are foreign-owned. Commodity contracts dealing, 79% foreign-owned. Motion picture and sound recording industry, 75% foreign-owned. Metal ore mining, 65% owned. Japan is sitting on $635 billion of our debt. China, $327 million of our debt. United Kingdom, $201 billion of our debt. The oil exporting countries, particularly Saudi Arabia, over $100 billion of our debt. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling. 13,730 companies have been sold over the last, since 1980, since Reagan came into power, for $1.6 trillion. 13,000 companies. Why? Because we've been borrowing money from the rest of the world to finance this insane economic policy. Hey, it's time for our progressive pop quiz. Today's question, according to ABC News, the FBI can eavesdrop on you through what personal device? The sixth caller with the correct answer wins a copy of Screwed. Troops in the Middle East who would love to be home for the holidays. What a tragedy. You know, what a flaming tragedy that George W. Bush, for political power. I mean, they played this thing. You go back and you look at 2002, you know, in August. No, we're not going to roll out a product in the summer. We wait till the fall, and then September comes, and sure enough, here it comes. Give us the war authority. And then they use it in November to beat up the Democrats and take the Senate back. And then the war. And all the oil. What a tragedy. Anyhow, welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question, once again, according to ABC News, the FBI can eavesdrop you on you through what personal device? And congratulations to Teresa Durkee in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Teresa, listening on WTKG in Grand Rapids. One of our longtime Clear Channel affiliates. Been with us for going on 3 years, I think. Maybe a little longer. And the answer, of course, cell phones. Even if they're turned off, the only way you can stop the FBI from listening in on you, take out the battery. How weird is that? 1-866-440-THOM is our telephone number, 866-440-8466. I want to get into it. We'll do it in the next hour. Just a little bit more of this whole story of what's going on with China and what's going on with the dollar. Because I have a big feeling we're going to be talking about it a lot next year as the sins of the Reagan Star of the Beast strategy and the Bush throw us into debt strategy start catching up with us. We'll get back to that. Mark in Middleville, Michigan. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Yes, Tom, I think something that most people don't realize is that the Federal Reserve has stopped publishing certain data.
Yeah, M3 specifically. M3 is a number that they stopped publishing in March of this year, which says this is the rate at which the Fed is producing money out of thin air relative to the rest of the money supply. And so, and the theory, and the reason why you produce money out of thin air is because your economy grows. So if your economy grows at 2%, if you don't produce money at the rate of 2%, then you have a deflationary environment. Your money becomes more valuable, and that's not a good thing. You want your money to be, you know, relatively in balance with your economy. But on the other hand, what happened after World War One, with the Treaty of Versailles, which said that the Germans had to pay back everybody for all the damage they did in World War One, and they didn't have enough money to pay back everybody. And the Treaty of Versailles required them to pay back in Deutschmarks. And so they said, that's fine, we'll just inflate the value, inflate the Deutschmark, deflate its value. And so they just ran the printing presses like crazy to the point where, you know, one Deutschmark would have bought a loaf of bread, but by the time they were done in 1926-27, it took a million Deutschmarks or a billion Deutschmarks to buy a loaf of bread. And then they said to France and Luxembourg and all their other, you know, allies, well, okay, here's your million Deutschmarks, here's your billion Deutschmarks, and they paid off their debt like that. And there are some people who are suggesting that the Reagan policy of starve the beast, the way that these guys, that these cons thought that they would destroy the social programs, because you have to keep in mind, this is all about undoing the New Deal. As Limbaugh said,
is dead.
Here,
his Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
It's all about destroying Social Security, destroying unemployment insurance, destroying Medicare and Medicaid, doing away with anything that has to do with the Great Society or with the New Deal. And they figured that the way to do that was to run the government so badly into debt that everybody would look around and go, holy cow, we can't afford anything anymore. We're going to have to make this country a conservative paradise. And so now we have an $8.5 trillion debt. Reagan ran up more debt than every president combined before him, and Bush has run up more debt than every president combined before him. And so now there's a lot of speculation around the world that the way that we're going to pay off that debt is the same way the Germans did in World War I. We're going to just run the printing presses like crazy. And in March of this year, we stopped publishing M3, which is the number that says how much we're running the printing presses, and it's got a lot of people very nervous.
Well, also, Tom, the dollar is now, you have to use $2 to get a British pound.
Yes.
You have to, our interest rates are going to go up to the roof, and we're going to be at the mercy of the Chinese.
We already are, Mark. We already are. I mean, we just already are. There's no other way to say it. General in the People's Liberation Army and Dean at the National Defense University in China commented to visiting Hong Kong reporters on Friday, this is from July of last year, that the People's Liberation Army might use nuclear weapons against the U.S. in a conflict over the Taiwan Strait. What did we do? Nothing. We can't do anything. They've got us. They're sitting on $1 trillion of our debt. And if they pull that debt, or if they stop buying our treasury, if they stop buying our debt, we're screwed. We're absolutely toast. It'll throw us into an absolute screaming disaster. Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Hey, Kirsten, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Tom. The information about the cell phones being bugged, so to speak.
Yeah, isn't that bizarre?
This ability to listen in on anything with a microphone device has been in place for over 10 years. There is a program, I'll remain nameless on every night syndicated throughout the country and now Europe, begins at 10 every night, who has aired Techno Geeks over the years.
Oh, are you talking about Alex Jones?
Pardon?
Are you talking about Alex Jones? No.
Yes, he's one of them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of people who've been talking about this. Yeah, and it's, I guess I'm late on the curve here. But Kirsten,
there were more that I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, we're out of town, but thank you very much. Yes, you're right. Anything with a loudspeaker can potentially be a microphone. Although those usually take some modification of electronics. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. The place we're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. I guess it's been a while. A lot of people don't remember Jeff Gannon. Anyway, welcome back to our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Quite a conversation over in our chat room, which you can get to by going to tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. About, am I a cold warrior or not? No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I thought the whole thing of let's get increasingly hysterical and afraid of people, particularly, and let's build up, you know, more and more munitions and have a bigger and bigger military. And they've got 11,000. They've got 6,000 nuclear weapons. We need 7. They've got 7. We need 8. They have 8. We need 9. It's crazy. And it's the same thing with relation to China. But the fact of the matter is that a general in the People's Liberation Army said, if the Americans draw their missiles and position-guided ammunition onto the target zone in China's territory, now he's not saying if we attack them, he's saying if we prepare to attack them. In other words, if we threaten to stop them from taking out Taiwan, this is Major General Zhu Shenzhou, he says, I think we will have to respond with nuclear weapons. We Chinese will prepare ourselves for the destruction of all the cities east of Xi'an in central China. Of course, the Americans will have to be prepared that hundreds of cities will be destroyed by the Chinese. Now, I don't consider this a threat. You know, and the government says, no, he's not speaking for us, but they haven't fired him. And I'm telling you, if an American general had said, well, you know, if the French were to involve themselves in our activities with Haiti and bring their missiles in and or bring their warships into the area, then we would just have to take out their cities. I don't think he'd be around for very long. But my point is, my point was, and you know, we're getting off on this minutia of whether or not I'm being paranoid about the Chinese, the communist Chinese, not the Taiwanese. And no, I'm not, in my opinion. I mean, I guess you can make up your own mind. But the point is, will China continue? This Andrew Bateson, and this is where we started with this thing, Andrew Bateson in today's Wall Street Journal. The growing size and sophistication of the domestic economy, this is of communist China, have made the outside world less important to China's economic vigor. That raises an important question. Will China continue to be ever more welcoming to foreign investment in the years ahead? In other words, to having American companies come in and build factories, not just American, other companies, multinational companies. It is increasingly trying to nurture homegrown companies rather than simply providing an attractive climate for multinational corporations to set up shop. China no longer needs to cater to the whims of foreign investors in order to grow, and so now we have U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson scheduled a visit to Beijing this week, part of a continuing effort by China's trading partners to deal with this new reality. What is the new reality? That China could destroy us. They don't need to use bombs. They don't need to use bombs at all. I mean, that's crazy. I'm sorry. If people in our chat room here, I was going to go to the phones, but somebody has tossed up a window on top of me, so I'm going to have to bounce that person out. In any case, here's the bottom line is that Japan was once notorious for the difficulty foreign companies faced in penetrating its maze of tariffs. And I can speak to that. I actually did business in Japan back in the 1970s. We had a company called Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems. We were importing picture tubes and anti-radiation screen shields for SAME from Japan. We had a strategic partnership with a company in Japan. And basically, you know, we wanted to start a Japanese company. Couldn't do it. Had to have a Japanese partner owned for more than 51%. There were all these rules. Japan was once notorious for the difficulty foreign companies faced in penetrating its maze of tariffs and regulations. Even though it is much more open now, imports still amount for only about 11% of the country's gross domestic product. The equivalent figure for China was 29%. So in other words, what we're seeing in China right now is that multinational companies are coming in, they're setting up shop. Walmart, for example, they have 66 stores in China. Whereas in India, there's not one. Why? Because India is protecting their economy. They're protecting their domestic economy. The country's entry into the WTO on December 11, 2001, this being China, started on a path of gradually lifting tariffs and other trade investment barriers. While China hasn't been released from its WTO obligations, it has come to the end of the changes it was specifically required to make under its terms of entry. And so there's a lot of concern about what is this going to mean? At the same time, the Financial Times is reporting. Now, this is just China. This is not just a China situation. China's not the only country that's holding our debt. Oil-producing countries have reduced their exposure to the dollar, this is from the Financial Times, to the lowest level in 2 years and continue in shifting income, oil income into euros, yen, and sterling. This confirms market speculation about a move out of dollars and could put new pressure on the ailing U.S. economy. So here you have Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, or the head of the Fed, who is stuck with this horrible decision that he has to make. Because of this $6.5 trillion debt that Bush, Reagan the first few years of Clinton, to Clinton's credit, Clinton cleaned up the debt. He actually, to some extent, I mean, he didn't clean up the debt, obviously, but he balanced the budget. How? By raising taxes. Let's bring in an amount of money equal to what we're paying out. Gee, it's like household income, right? You spend what you make. And then George W. Bush coming along and adding another $3 trillion or so to the debt. And by the way, I remember back during the Reagan years when he first started. I mean, you know, when Reagan came into office, our debt was about $1 trillion. It's now over $8 trillion. And Reagan cranked it up by about $3 trillion, and everybody was saying, and even in the, I mean, there was a recession in the middle of that, a rather severe one, actually. And everybody would say, oh, look at this, the economy's doing great under Reagan. Because he handed over $1 trillion to his buddies who got him elected in the oil industry and primarily in the defense industry to do his Star Wars thing. You know, all these defense contractors making out like bandits saying, oh, this is great. And my comment was at the time, and still is, yeah, it looks like we're living large. You give me a credit card with a $1 trillion debt line that my children or grandchildren are going to have to pay, I can show you what it looks like to live large. Give me a credit card with a $1 million credit limit, and I'll show you, you know, as a person, and make sure that my children or my grandchildren are going to have to pay for it. I'll show you what it looks like to live large. And everybody will look and go, oh, look at that. He's got a nice house. Look at that Mercedes. He must be doing really well. It's all on credit. Well, you have that, plus we have this incredible balance of trade deficit. This is where we're buying about $800 billion a year from the world of stuff. About a third of it is oil, about two-thirds of it is stuff. And of the stuff, about 75% of that is from China, which brings us back to China. We're buying all this stuff, and what's happening? We're giving them dollars, and they're sitting here with these dollars, $800 billion a year. $800,000 million a year, and they're saying, okay, what are we going to do with these dollars? What are we going to do with them? Well, let's see. I think we'll buy Chrysler. That seems like a good plan. I think we'll buy Oregon Steel. We'll buy U.S. Steel. We'll buy a chunk of Ford. We'll buy on and on it goes. But we continue to buy foreign stuff. 90% of the footwear we buy in the United States comes from overseas. 87% of the audio and video equipment we buy in the United States comes from overseas. 86% of our leather products. 67% of our apparel and accessories. And so what are these companies, what are these countries doing with all these dollars that they're sitting on? They're saying, let's buy America. And the Bushies and the whole Reagan guys, they say, oh, isn't that wonderful? It's insourcing. The whole Thomas Friedman world is flat crowd. Look at that. Toyota's building a factory in Ohio. They're going to hire people. Yeah, they're going to give you a job building Toyotas and taking the profit back to Japan. This is the hollowing out of the American economy. It's the destruction of the American middle class, step by step. 16 minutes past the hour. In a world full of people, only some want to fly. Is that not crazy? Crazy. In a world full of people, some want to fly. Is that crazy? Crazy. 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 Sometimes you learn the most amazing things 21 minutes past the hour. One of the folks in our chat room. How do you get into a hotel? You show up for a hotel. Your room's not ready yet. Sorry, you're going to have to sit and wait. So one of the folks in the chat room, was it blueberry picking? Was that it, David? Yeah. Who is a woman, as I recall. Yeah. Says she just started taking her clothes off. And they found a room for her really, really quickly. And that's great. And then Fawn says, where'd it go? Fawn says, yeah, that was the St. Christopher Hotel. She says, I waited politely for 2 hours before I started processing my room. So then Fawn says, one time Jehovah's Witnesses locked at the door in the early morning, and I entered the door topless and said, any of you a virgin? We need a virgin. And they ran for the hills. Strange things going on in the chat room. Anyway, yeah, no, don't go there. Yeah. KnightsTemplar.com. These are the websites to stay away from. Knights Templar, KnightsTemplar.com. Priory of Sion.com. Don't do that. PRIORYOFSION.com. Yeah. So, anyhow, we were talking about the oil, and then we're going to get to your call. I promise you we will get to them. 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Our telephone number. Russia, this back to the Financial Times piece, Russia and the members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries cut their dollar holdings from 67% in the first quarter to 65% in the second quarter. And you say, hey, they're cutting their dollar holdings by 2%. What's the big deal? What it means is that if they continue to stop buying dollars, in order to get the world to buy dollars, as long as Bush keeps running things up on a credit card, and he's been doing this I used the phrase a month or so ago, a drunken sailor, and I got an email from a sailor. I should have known, right? My brother-in-law's a sea captain. He says, hey, you're giving sailors a bad name, especially drunken ones. In any case, he's spending money hand over fist, you know, pick your cliche. And yeah, it makes the economy look okay. I mean, we have a debt-driven economy, but the problem is that as any householder can tell you, I mean, anybody who has a home, anybody who's ever had a paycheck, if you live entirely on debt, you wipe out the value of your house, you borrow your house up to its max, you run your credit cards up to their max, there's a day of reckoning going to come. A point at which people say, okay, enough already. And Reagan thought he could play this slick little game with Greenspan's help. And this is why Greenspan bailed out and dropped this whole thing in Bernanke's lap. Reagan and Greenspan thought they could play this cute little game where let's run up this huge debt. Now, that was the spend money inside the United States and borrow from the rest of the world thing, because there's two debts here, right, that we're talking about. Reagan thought he could run up this huge debt. And he also had this philosophy that tariffs, protecting domestic industries, that say, you know, if you make a, you know, if there's a, as I said, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes here, and you make them in China where it costs 20 cents, you pay 80 cents when you import them, so you might as well make them here because it's going to cost you the same. And we used to have thousands of tariffs on everything. And that's how we had a strong middle class. That's why there were jobs at that textile mill that John Edwards' parents worked at, was because of tariffs on textiles. I mean, it's pretty straightforward stuff. So, you know, Reagan and the ideologues around him and the conservatives, ever since that time, and really going back to the 60s and the 50s, they were actually going back to Alexander Hamilton, going back to the founding of this country, the conservatives have thought, we should do away with this. We should just let the free market decide. Everything will be fine if we let the big multinational corporations make the decisions. We don't need no stinking democracy. As Yarnbrook, who started out this program with the Ayn Rand Institute, he puts the market above democracy. He'll be the first to honestly say so. That's the position of libertarians, although typically they're not honest about it. And the consequence of that, the consequence of all this debt, is that the bill's going to come due. And then at the same time, you know, once you've done away with your barriers to trade, your tariffs, and you say, okay, you can make anything you want, anywhere you want, then these multinational corporations start looking for cheap labor. They start looking for cheap labor all over the world. Wherever the labor is cheapest, that's where they go. And they take our jobs from here to there. And we wonder why we don't have jobs and we don't have the money anymore. The old-fashioned economics, the economics that ruled this country that everybody understood for 200 years. It was called demand-side economics. It was really simple. If people have money, they buy things. If they have more money, they buy more things. As they're buying things, it creates the demand for goods and services. And so people, small businesses, will start to fill that demand for goods and services. It's why Roosevelt, to get us out of the Great Depression, gave people jobs. The WPA, the CCC, things like that. Give them some money, and they'll buy things. As they buy things, it's going to get us out of it. And it worked. But these guys say, no. The solution is to give multimillionaires and billionaires tax breaks, and maybe they will build a factory with that money. Well, they did. Bush was right when he said, $500,000 per job. Let's give them a tax break. It was $500,000 per job. And sure enough, they built factories in China, in Mexico. And this is the disaster. So now it looks like the governments around the world are saying, okay, we're not trusting the dollar anymore. What's that going to mean? Right after this, 27 minutes past the hour.
And it said, no, 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 no. Said, no, no, you're not the one for me. No. You're not the one for me.
And no, you're not, George. Welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And it seems like it might be a good time before we go any farther just to take a moment and check out what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation. No, it's not a war. I'm sorry. The war is over. The war was declared won. On May 1st, 2003, George Bush was right. He was victorious. We did win the war. We did knock down their government. We did take control of their buildings. We did destroy their army. That was the end of the war. The ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq and the civil war that is deriving from same.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're not the ones.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq as of 0800 GMT on Monday, this is from Reuters. Dateline Baghdad, three U.S. soldiers were killed and two wounded by a roadside bomb in Baghdad. A car bomb exploded in a parking lot in Mahamoun University in Baghdad, killing one person and wounding four. Roadside bomb went off in Palestine Street in western Baghdad, killing one person and wounding six. In El Kermato, a gunman stormed a house and killed six members of one family, wounded the father in a village near Tuz Kermato, 70 miles south of Baghdad. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb targeting a U.S. military patrol killed a soldier and wounded another on Sunday. In Baghdad, a suicide bomber blew himself up near a house used as a base by police commando, killing a policeman and wounding five others in the Dura district. A roadside bomb wounded a man in the Sharia area in central Baghdad. In Ramadi, U.S. forces killed two insurgents and wounded two on Saturday night. In Baghdad, U.S. and Iraqi forces arrested six men on Sunday suspected of sectarian killings. And in Baghdad, U.S. and Iraqi forces arrested four suspected insurgents. Not the news. So, anyhow, just to wrap this all up, I said Bernanke is faced with this horrible choice. And we're going to see. I believe there's a Fed meeting this week. In fact, I think it's tomorrow or the next day. Odds are they won't do anything at this meeting, but they might. On the one hand, because of the bursting housing bubble, which is the result of the rising interest rates, see, Greenspan, in order to get W reelected, dropped interest rates to the point where they were actually negative. The interest rate, the prime rate was below the rate of inflation, which meant if you borrowed money and sat on it, by the time you paid it back, it was worth more than when you borrowed it, which is insane. It just doesn't happen. Never happened before. And what that did was it caused all kinds of people to say, you know, hey, the interest rates are low. I can afford more house because it's, you know, people don't buy houses based on what they cost. They buy them based on their payments. Payments went down. People said, hey, I can buy more house. What that did is it drove up housing prices because the payments were going down. So Greenspan creates this housing bubble housing prices exploding. Bernanke comes in. He says, this is nuts. He starts raising interest rates back up to a reasonable level. The housing bubble starts to burst. We're seeing housing prices collapse all around the United States. People can't use their house as an ATM anymore. They don't have a piggy bank. We had negative savings last year. People spent more money than they saved, and more money than they earned, rather. And so as a consequence, the economy is starting to slow down, and it could start to slow down really bad, really fast. So to stop that from happening, Bernanke has to lower interest rates and get that housing bubble going again, or at least get housing prices back stable. But the problem is, if he lowers interest rates, China won't want to borrow any more money from us or buy any more money. They won't want to loan us any more money. And not just China. China, Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, Japan, England, the company, the big buyers of U.S. Treasury bonds and bills. They'll say, you know, why should we borrow? Why should we buy debt instruments from the United States that only pay 4%, 4.5% when we can buy them in euros that are paying 5.5%, 6%? Because the European economy is heating up, and so they're increasing their interest rates to slow things down. So Bernanke needs to raise interest rates in order to get them to keep loaning us money, because Bush and Reagan have put us on this disastrous course where the only way we can keep the government afloat, and it's an economy held together with baling wire and spit. The only way we can keep it going is by borrowing money. And in order to get other countries to loan us money, we have to raise interest rates. But if he does that, he's going to make the housing bubble even worse. It's going to pop even harder, which is going to crash the economy into a depression. So he's got a choice. He can lower interest rates and crash us into a recession that might become hyperinflationary, in which case interest rates will end up going up to 20, 30% anyway. Or he can raise interest rates and crash the housing market even further and slide us into a good old-fashioned deflationary depression. What's he going to do? I think the guy's terrified. The Fed governors and Bernanke are saying completely different things. These are the kind of disasters. I realize some of this sounds kind of erudite, and typically on our show we don't get into stuff at this level of detail. But this is the consequence of the insane policies brought to you courtesy of Ronald Reagan and the ideologues inside the Republican Party. And there's a few of them in the Democratic Party as well. Mark in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Yeah, thanks for the show. Turning up. Just a minute, I got to turn off my loudspeaker, okay?
Sure.
Okay, sorry about that. But, yeah, I don't think the problem's really China, the government of China, or the people of China, but...
No, I wasn't saying it is. I'm saying that Reagan put us in a position, Reagan and Bush put us in a position where we are so beholden to them that they can say or do pretty much anything, and all we have to do is say, yes, sir.
Right, but I don't want to frame the Chinese government as some kind of menace or threat, because I think the threat is right here at home, and we need to address, for example, the fact that this latest deal to ship nuclear technology to India is a prime example, because there's been this transfer of proprietary information due to research and development, public research and development dollars. For example, the nuclear industry has got this prohibitively high cost to get into the industry, so it's all been publicly funded. But somehow, Tom, the proprietary information from nuclear R&D publicly funded got into the hands of public companies. Somehow, it just miraculously happened.
It's just amazing. It's called privatization.
Trillions of dollars of revenue from that proprietary R&D, which is now in public hands based on fraud. Billions of trillions of public revenue now is going to be handed to India. Mm-hmm. So essentially the problem is lawmakers who have allowed monopolistic transnationals to effectively take over our economy based on fraud.
They haven't just allowed it. They have aggressively participated in it, because these are the people who are paying their bills. These are the people who are paying to get them reelected.
So it's going to be restitution, not redistribution. Very important fact and distinction. Restitution, not redistribution. We can appropriate the assets of these filthy whore companies all around the world. We'll have the wealthiest economy in the world. It's not the Chinese people or the Chinese government. It's the filthy leaders, economically, transnationals, and political. We got to hold them accountable. Thank you.
I don't disagree. We 52 of the 100 largest economies are not governments, they're corporations. There's something wrong with that. OMD in Springfield, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, OMD, what's up?
Oh, just a little quickie about two good books. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones will explain some of the game that's going on. And Crossing the Rubicon, Michael Rupert.
Oh, yeah. Michael Rupert's been on the program before. He pushes the boundaries of what may be from time to time, but he often also is the little boy who points out that the emperor's wearing no clothes. He does a good job of that.
Yeah, he got so close to the truth that they ran him out of the country.
Yeah, anyway. You're right. Yeah, he's living down in South America someplace now, isn't he?
Anyway, going back to this Skull and Bones connection with the corporate power, 1886, M.R. Waite, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in a two-sentence declaration without debate, gave corporations the rights of people. He was Skull and Bones. And you look at the list of Skull and Bones in Fleshing Out Skull and Bones book, and it's amazing. You know, people like...
You're saying Davis was Skull and Bones?
Say again?
Davis, the Supreme Court recorder in the 1886 Santa Clara County case, is that who you're talking about? John Chandler Bancroft Davis was the guy who actually wrote that. Waite never said that.
Okay, but
Davis wrote that into the headnote, and it was published about 3 months after Waite died of heart failure. So I actually wrote an entire book about this. It's called Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Power and the Death of the Theft of Human Rights. You might want to check it out. Anyhow, Armin and Braden, but thanks for the call. Armin and Braden in Florida. You have about a minute before we've got to take a break. Armin, what's up?
Let me read this to you real quick, then, if I got a minute. Rights of the free people in a constitutional republic. A corporation's right to proprietary privacy and secrecy cannot exceed the public's right to accountability and disclosure in the public voting process, especially there where the free will and the right of the individual and the expression of that constitutional right is protected by the representatives of a free people in a constitutional republic.
Stop reading, Armin. What's the point?
In the 13th district, they're going to try to use the clause coming up. They got a judge, the 15th, that's supposed to decide if proprietary rights of a corporation exceeds the right of the public's right to make them disclose the software in those crooked voting machines.
I got it. Yeah, and they already have. I mean, for all practical purposes, they already have. That the proprietary trade secrets trump everything. Here's what's bizarre. Is that we are allowing our vote to be privatized. 45 minutes past the hour.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight. Walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is a bluebird, and here to stay.
Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Those of you who listen to our program regularly are familiar with the voice of Doug Cunningham, Labor Radio News, laborradio.org, their website. Doug, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us. Our weekly labor segment here, just talking about what's the state of American labor. The AFL-CIO has an organizing summit going on. Tell us about this.
Yeah, they just wrapped up over the weekend in Washington, D.C. About 600 activists, organizers from all around the country gathering to hammer out the nuts and bolts strategies of getting more workers into unions. And they're very pumped and excited about it. They're putting about $150 million more each year into union organizing, and they're very excited about the Employee Free Choice Act in Congress, because before the Democratic control of the Congress happened, they had 218 supporters in the U.S. House for this act, and over in the Senate, 44 supporters. So now with the Democrats in the majority, they think they're going to have even more support and be able to get this through. And what this will do is eliminate the factor of employer intimidation or threats when workers want to join unions, making it easier for workers to join unions and to improve themselves.
Well, in fact, the Employee Free Choice Act, I mean, the Republicans, for all practical purposes, would not even allow it to be discussed.
Yeah, that's right.
Well have gotten a whole lot more vote, you know, a lot more supporters if somebody had brought the thing to the, you know, if they had had committee discussions and if they had been brought to the floor.
Oh, it's critical that the leadership do that. And Labor, of course, was critical in the election results. And so this all plays in, and hopefully it'll get passed. Of course, Bush probably won't sign it. But this is a multi-year effort, and they are underway with this effort, and they hope to get it into law at some point in the United States. And if they do, that'll be a huge historic shift in the rights of workers to really organize and form unions without fear of...
Indeed. Really, in my opinion, what we need to do is go all the way back to 1947 and repeal Taft-Hartley. But I'll take anything I can get right now. So, yeah, I have to confess, Doug, I am not familiar with all the provisions of the Employee Free Choice Act. Does it allow for card check?
It does allow for card checks, and they will be certified, of course, by the National Labor Relations Board. But
okay, let's explain to our listeners what card check is.
Yeah, what card check is the majority of workers at a workplace sign union cards saying, yes, we want this union to represent us. And then those cards are certified by the National Labor Relations Board, and then the employer is compelled by law to recognize that the employee's free choice in this case and recognize that union and then bargain for a contract.
Yeah,
okay, and it also puts teeth into labor law violations. So if employers violate labor law, they'll be fined up to $20,000 per incident.
How do we deal with the fact that the current National Labor Relations Board, a board that was originally created in 1935 or 36 by the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, as a defender of labor, that the composition of that board right now is a majority of the people on that board are hostile to labor, and that board has been actively and aggressively working against the interests of labor. In fact, the Department of Labor has even had some website instructions on basically how to bust a union.
Yeah, that's right. They are very anti-labor, and as you pointed out, the original intent was to actually promote collective bargaining and to protect the rights of labor. And unfortunately, the best way and probably the only way to change that is the President of the United States. You change the composition.
Because he's the one who appoints the members.
That's right. That's right. And you get a new president in who will appoint pro-labor members, members who are going to carry out the original intent of that act, and make it the policy of the United States to promote collective bargaining, and that would make a huge, huge difference for workers all over the country.
So we have to be looking at the next election here very seriously.
Absolutely.
In your mind, Doug, you know, independent of any labor organization, who are the Democratic potential candidates who you think would be best for labor in the United States?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to say at this point who would be at the absolute best. John Edwards.
John Edwards would be the top of the pack.
Yeah, I think he's at the top of the pack of the people that are prominently mentioned now, especially. And I think, you know, there are certain issues, there are problems with Hillary Clinton in terms of trade policies. Barack Obama is really untested in terms of labor, I think. So I think John Edwards would be at the top of that.
Yeah. Howard Dean would do well, too.
Yeah, I think so. And whoever does well, whoever gets the nomination should understand how critical labor was in getting the Democratic majority elected in Congress. And
organized labor is starting, speaking of which, I mean, the war was a big issue. Organized labor is starting to speak out about the war.
U.S. Labor Against the War has been speaking out for some time against it. The AFL-CIO is on record nationally as wanting a U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. And Bill Samuel, the legislative director of the AFL-CIO, tells me that they'll be pushing hard to put pressure on Congress to in turn put pressure on Bush to begin a serious withdrawal from Iraq and get our troops out of there, stop the unnecessary expenditure of both life and money, and then we'll be able to focus on achieving some other things domestically.
That'd be an amazing thing. And we have a little over a minute to go. A brief mention of the Goodyear strikers and the NASCAR element to that. How does NASCAR tie into the Goodyear strike?
Well, Goodyear workers build NASCAR tires right now. They have scabs building those tires. Goodyear's a quintessential American brand, wants to import 10 times more tires from China. And at the same time,
is Goodyear still an American-owned company?
It is, and it's based in Akron. But they still want to import 10 times more tires from China. They want to end retiree health benefits. United Steelworkers are taking a stand to protect the benefits those retirees have earned and to keep those jobs in America. And the NASCAR fans, if you're a NASCAR fan born in the USA, you ought to be also a union fan and stand with the union because they're trying to defend American jobs here.
And what union is dealing with this?
It's the United Steelworkers. United Steelworkers.
Making rubber.
Yeah, and there are about 15,000 of them. They're on strike now. They're in the ninth week. I believe the strike started October 5th, and they are shutting down or trying to shut down the Goodyear plants, but the plants are still operating now with scab labor.
Great. Doug Cunningham, you can read all about it over at laborradio.org.
Thanks, Tom.
He's a reporter anchor with the Workers' Independent News Service. Doug, thanks so much for being with us today. Good talking with you. And thank you for being with us today. Time to wrap up the program. We will be back tomorrow. I'll be debating conservative David Tebow on media bias about global warming. They're still at it, I'm telling you. And Charles Derber's here on his new book, Hidden Power, What You Need to Know to Save Our Democracy. That and more in your calls. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.